Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Growing Forward, a podcast about cannabis in New Mexico and a collaboration between New Mexico PBS and New Mexico Political Report. I'm Megan Kamrick, a New Mexico PBS correspondent and an on-air host and reporter with KUNM.
And I'm Andy Lyman with New Mexico Political Report.
This week, as many listeners likely know, the New Mexico legislature approved adult use cannabis in a recent marathon session, and Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham is expected to sign that bill any day now. So today we're talking to a few of the sponsors of that bill, Representatives Deborah Armstrong and Javier Martinez, and we're hoping to be joined by Representative Andrea Romero. Welcome, representatives.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Representative Armstrong, we spoke with you about your family's history with medical cannabis in one of our early episodes. One of the selling points of legalization has been the potential tax revenue and increased jobs for the state. But while presenting this proposal in the legislature, you said a few times you were coming at this from a public health perspective. For those who may have missed those committee meetings, can you talk a bit about that perspective?
Sure. My concern is street drugs. So cannabis is already out there, heavily used, adults too frequently with children and youth. And we don't know what's in it. There's more and more stories of it being laced with fentanyl. Always concerned about contaminants. You don't know how it was grown. You don't know the strength or quality. And so by legalizing it, we can regulate that and we can test for it and make sure of what it is that we are consuming. And secondly, we have are trying to manage access by kids, and particularly by controlling packaging and marketing, childproof packaging. You can't, like what happens in other states, Colorado didn't do this. And so they have edibles that look like candy bars, a common candy bar from the outside. So you don't know, it makes it attractive to children. So we want to control that. We want to be able to educate. I would love to see a lot of this revenue used for education in the schools, for research about how it's best used, research on ill effects on, everyone talks about driving. I think people are driving having consumed it now. So we need to figure that out. And rather than just a simply no, it's illegal, how much is okay? How much is too much? And how do we monitor any other negative impacts on the health of New Mexico, and then do what we can to regulate and counter that.
So you feel like making it legal gives us more of a framework to address these public health issues?
That's right. That's right.
Okay. And the way this was painted in many ways was as a partisan effort. Would you care, or would you also categorize it that way, considering this bill was really years in the making?
It was years in the making. And I think there's been a number of Republicans interested. And just by the, you know, the mere fact we had Republicans introduce bills this year, the effort to do this is bipartisan. Okay. The exact mechanism and what you control and what you don't, what you have in the bill and what you don't, is maybe the difference. But the interest in legalizing and regulating, I think, is bipartisan.
Do you feel as the bill evolved that more of those perspectives were incorporated?
I do. I think that there was lots of conversation, and Representative Martinez can talk a lot more to this. I did more of a behind the scenes, but I think every time that I was aware and people came to me or raised issues, we worked to address them. You know, I worked with Representative Martinez and Romero, as well as the superintendent of insurance and so forth, to raise different issues and get it amended in the bill. And some joked about it being amended every hour, but that's because we kept getting feedback as people were able to view it and read it and digest it, a big bill. And it, you know, the more people read, the more things that they might've identified. So we had lots of tweaks along the way and years of working on this.
during the debates, these most recent debates this week, some lawmakers raised concerns about our state's existing problems with addiction, and they questioned whether legal cannabis would exacerbate that problem. What do you think?
You know, I think there's a lot of folks who have talked about being able to use cannabis as a way to get off of harder drugs, but they haven't had a good legal way to do that. And so it's not as harmful, I don't believe, as, other opioids and heroin and so forth. And so I think it's actually a pathway to potentially deal more effectively with addiction. But no substance that you put into your body, whether it's alcohol, cigarettes, marijuana, other things, is completely fine. I mean, we know that from alcohol and tobacco. That doesn't mean to keep cannabis off the market and not deal with it. I just don't think we can adequately control it and deal with it if it's just simply illegal. So, and we don't have any ability to regulate and control it. So that's my take on it. And my interest has not been, hopefully we raise lots of money. It would be fine with me if every penny of that money went back into public health and making this even better, and it not be a source of some new magic revenue source for the state, but pay for what we really need to do for behavioral health and substance abuse, not just because of cannabis, but we have a mechanism to raise from cannabis a funding source for all of those related issues.
Just really quickly, so a technical question to answer here is, we know that legal sales start on April 1st, but when do the other things go into effect? When can people start growing their own, cultivating at home, and actually just being in possession?
Yeah, thanks, Sandy, for the time and the question. On the date that the bill becomes law, which will be 90 days after the governor signs it, and we don't know quite yet when the governor will sign it. I expect it'll happen in the next few days, but 90 days from then.
And so this has kind of become your thing, right? I mean, I mentioned before, I was so pleasantly interrupted by my dog, that this was something you've been working on for a while, right? It was kind of a transition. You and Secretary McCamley were working on this together. And since then, it's kind of been your thing going forward, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. This is really, I think, an effort that has been led by so many amazing leaders. Former Representative McCamley is the first one I worked with. But, you know, before then, we know Chairwoman Armstrong had been laying the foundation, really. I mean, we're not here without the medical program. I mean, I think that's just a fact, and not just in the state, but across the country. And then in the other chamber, you know, you had folks like Senator McSorley, like Senator Tisipino, folks who were laying the groundwork longer before I came on board. I think with this particular bill, this particular piece of legislation, it is a continuation of that famous or infamous Cannabis Freedom Act from 2015, which I know, Andy, you've commented on Twitter about. It received 5 committee assignments from former Speaker Don Tripp. And then a couple years after that, the bill got a little bit more favorable treatment in its committee assignments. And Representative McCamley endured something like a 4 or 5 hour hearing in the former House Business and Industry Committee, after which his bill was tabled. To me, this is really a collective effort. And I just happened to be the person who took it over for McCamley once he left. We're not at this stage of the game without Chairwoman Armstrong, without Representative Romero, who came in as a co-sponsor for the first time this year. And my goodness, she is just an incredible, incredible co-sponsor. Her debate skills and her ability to tackle really tough questions in such an informative and in almost dispassionate way, you know, to try to get the points across has been incredible. I think that at the end of the day, if anybody wants to ask what the difference, who the difference maker was, I think it might have been Representative Romero.
And we are hoping that Representative Romero will be able to join us. She is on the road. So hopefully she'll be able to join us on this Facebook Live.
she's got to defend herself from everything I'm saying. So.
So I just wanted to clarify that when this takes effect, we know legal sales start by April 1st, 2022, but the law goes into effect, of course, after the governor signs the bill. I just want to, that's right.
Now, 90 days after the governor signs the bill.
Okay, I'm sorry you said that. Mm-hmm. Colorado's Governor Jared Polis recently just signed a law to address equity in their market, and other states have passed similar legislation through voter referendums or are making tweaks to their laws. They didn't go through kind of this long legislative process we just saw. Should we expect similar adjustments in the coming years? And what are some of the areas that you all might tackle in the next legislative session?
Megan, I would be surprised and very disappointed if we don't go back and tweak this piece of legislation. I've said it from the get-go. I am not afraid of amendments. I am not afraid of changes during the legislative process. That's what the legislative process is for. If you pass a bill of this magnitude and it doesn't go any changes, there's something wrong with the process. So, now that it passed and we expect governor to sign it, I would expect us to come back in the 30-day session to begin to make some adjustments. One that I've talked about often is to ensure that we can set up that rural equity fund and also to set up some sort of funding source for behavioral health and treatment services, as Senator Steinborn raised on the Senate floor a couple of days ago. Beyond that, as the regulators do their jobs between the day the governor signs this bill and the next legislative session, I'm sure they'll come across things that will need to be adjusted. And so I've never made any bones about it. Like, we will be back in the 30-day making adjustments. And then as the framework gets rolled out, right, as we start sales on or before April 1st, 2022, there are gonna be plenty of opportunities to make adjustments from the regulatory framework to the tax piece, right? Because remember, that's also an important piece of this, to public safety, to a number of different things. And I welcome, every single colleague in the legislature to come forward with ideas as the years go by to ensure that this is a framework that continues to work for everyone and a framework that is continues to be a smart regulatory approach to cannabis.
We've amended the medical over the years. A few times to add different things or tweak different things as we've learned more and as the program has grown. So I agree, there will probably be tweaks over time. Much of it will be done in regulation, but we'll stumble across something that actually needs legislation, I'm sure.
Just real quick, that it seems to be that it's not unique to just this piece of legislation, right? Anybody that's been sort of watching this, or you two as lawmakers, this is kind of how it goes, right? It's a unicorn to say that there's a perfect piece of legislation that passes that never has to be touched again, right?
Yeah,
that's correct. And I think case in point is our Liquor Control Act. For many years, and to this day, it is very difficult to do things like raise taxes. We have not raised taxes on the excise tax on alcohol in over 20 to 25 years. Even the idea of reshaping the licensing process was a Herculean task. And big props to Chairman Maestas and some of the other folks who worked on that this session. But that's not how I envision this framework to be. I mean, if we're sitting here in 25 years and it has not been tweaked at all, it would have been a massive failure on our part as policymakers.
Oh, Andy, I think I didn't want to jump on you. You had a question about when people can start home cultivation.
Yes, I think that's as soon as we determine that's when the law goes into effect. Okay. So 90 days, right? Yeah.
Okay. Well, you all raise an interesting point, because there was a continual criticism during the debate this week that the bill was not ready. There were too many unknowns. It was being rushed through. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't see how a five-year effort is rushed through. 5 years five legislative sessions that we've gone through.
It's evolved over that time, right?
it has evolved, mm-hmm. right? And there's an interesting thing happening, right? The bill has evolved over that time, but it's not an entirely new bill, right? When you get down to the nuts and bolts, it is not that different, right? There are some things that we adjusted. There are some things that we changed at the request of experts, at the request of industry people, at the request of the regulators, at the request of members of the other party. One of your previous questions was, you know, this is perceived as a partisan effort. Not at all. Republicans, at least the Republicans who were willing to work with us on legalization, and we know there's a small handful of them, many of their ideas are incorporated into this bill. The idea of pulling out the expungement mechanism into a separate bill came from them, right? The idea of consignment comes from them. I was deeply disappointed that at the very end, before the final vote on this bill, a Senate Republican would go on a diatribe about how partisan this process had been. It didn't have to be this bipartisan, right? It really didn't. You know, we probably could have finished this off a year or two ago, but you know, in our effort to collaborate and to bring other perspectives into this work, we opened the door for those folks. And you know, unfortunately, they kept moving the goalposts. And at the end of the day, I'm just very glad that our governor pushed as hard as she did to get this done. New Mexicans have wanted this for a long time. And it would have been a huge missed opportunity had we allowed a small group of Republican obstructionists at the end of the regular 60-day session to actually control the fate of this bill. This process was very much bipartisan, even if the other side fails to concede.
Why was it strategically a good idea to separate the expungement into a separate bill? Why did you all
do that? So, you know, according to some of those same Republicans, and according to other, I guess, more centrist Democrats, you know, there were a lot of folks who were willing to vote on cannabis, but not necessarily on expungement and vice versa. To an extent, to a degree, I think perhaps that there was also more of a technical position on that as well, right? Meaning that here you have a cannabis regulatory framework, and then you've got this strictly criminal justice reform piece, right? And so to us, we were not gonna legalize without ensuring expungement. That was our red line. We were not gonna go there. When we were assured that in fact, the expungement bill would move, and as we were tracking it, we were gonna ensure that that bill moved first. And sure enough, you know, the Senate, the Senate lived up to its end of the bargain, and next thing we knew, we had expungement in the House ready to go. And so that's when we decided to deploy and get cannabis out and to begin Senate considerations. But you know, those are the reasons why. But I'll tell you what, legalization in the state does not happen without that expungement mechanism. It was that important and it was that critical for all of us.
During some of these debates, we heard a lot of sort of concerns about how safe cannabis can be. And I think Representative Armstrong sort of addressed this earlier on that, you know, you can't compare it to something that is absolutely completely safe. There's obviously some impacts there. But is it a matter of time before things get normalized with this? And I know it's not necessarily the right comparison to alcohol, but that's the closest thing I have in my head of something that's used and it's accepted. There's not sort of like little jokes and jabs of people that use it. Is it just a matter of time before it becomes normalized in everyday life, so to speak? That's for either of you two.
I think so. And particularly the more states that pass it, that we're not isolated. I mean, we're not isolated now with some surrounding states. New York beat us by a day in legalizing. And I think the more states that come on board, all the more normalized it becomes. And when it's more normalized, I would say you also have a much broader opportunity to educate about appropriate use, to research about appropriate use, and we're not standing alone, and no one state is standing alone trying to figure that out. And so I hope soon we're past the critical mass of states that something is done federally and we can really take it on and appropriately control it, get rid of the black market, and do the appropriate education and training on appropriate use and keeping it out of the hands of children.
To that effect, as the bill evolved, the tax rate changed. So the excise tax will be 12% on sales. That eventually increases to 18%. But that's before the standard taxes on sales, gross receipts of 5 to 9%. That could push the overall tax rate eventually well above 20%, which many have considered that sort of the sweet spot to have a robust legal market while undercutting the illegal market, which is one of the main goals, as you say, of the legislation. Why the higher tax rate? What do you think about that possibility?
Yeah, Megan, I can respond to that. You know, the 20%, I think, as I've said it many times in committee, probably one too many times, comes from experts in tax policy who have studied how different states tax cannabis. And so, you know, there's sort of that sweet spot, right? On or about 20%. Most of our surrounding states, including obviously Arizona and Colorado, they hover above that 20%. Colorado, I think it's upwards of, you know, closer to 30. When the amendment was brought up to me, two things I think were critical. Number one, staying within that range, right? So we weren't going to go from 12% excise tax to a 25% excise tax in addition to the applicable GRT. I mean, that would have not been, I think, a good thing. But I think to do from 12 to 18%, 6 percentage points, and then phased in over the course of 6 years, I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure that anyone purchasing cannabis through the legal market in years 1, 2, 3, and 4 is gonna turn back to the illicit market at the end of year 6, simply because cannabis increased by a 1% excise tax point. So, you know, I think that total tax ultimately will hover around 25-26%, well within the margin that we had set forth. The other reason I was very comfortable with the idea of raising the excise tax is that, as I pointed out several times during debate, this is the first time in a long time that New Mexico gets to create a brand new multi-million dollar industry from scratch per the rules that we're setting. And that is a fantastic opportunity from the regulatory piece to the tax piece to ensure that we do it right. And so as I was discussing with some of the appropriators within the legislature about how much revenue this could potentially bring to the state, the idea came up of, okay, maybe we do need to look at a slightly higher tax rate. And then after that, we negotiated, you know, do we do it year one or do we do it phased in? Do we do it phased in over 3 years or 6 years? You know, what is the exact rate of the proposed hike? And so to me, it makes sense to do so. Now, I'll tell you what, if in years 3 and 4, we feel like, you know, when the excise tax is 16%, we feel that potentially we're beginning to push the bounds, we can always come back and stop the phasing, right? But at the end of the day, I think 26% is not cost prohibitive. We're still well below Colorado. We're right there with Arizona. I think it'll be fine.
I guess it's probably important to note that, excuse me, that that increase doesn't start until about 3 years into after sales start, right? So we're going to have sales 22, 23, 24, and it's not until 2025 that we see a 1% increase, right?
That is correct.
Can I ask a nerdy tax question, just so we clarify?
We do have the tax chairman here, so it's probably the time to ask those nerdy
questions. The difference between excise and gross receipts, I'm not sure everybody knows that in terms of where that, how that money is collected and funneled, and if it looks any different to a consumer.
It will not look different to a consumer, except maybe on your receipt. Okay. But it's a very similar process on the back end from the taxation and revenue department's point of view.
Okay. And it goes, what's interesting is that we sort of, as the bill evolved, we haven't designated necessarily where any of this tax revenue is going to go. So we're kind of holding off for a session in the future to allot that.
You know, I take thanks for asking that question, because I take it for granted that everybody just sort of assumes this, right? But the funds are going somewhere. They're going to the state's general fund. We just have not earmarked the funds in this bill. So what's going to happen is these revenues will go into the state's general fund, which are then appropriated by the legislature, you know, through its appropriations process.
Okay.
This is also a question for either one of you. The passage of this effort has been called historic, transformative, and a list of other superlatives. So what makes this measure so different from the long list of things that were passed in the regular session?
Look, I think the entire session, and you know, at this point, it was not a 60-day session. It was a 62-day session, I guess.
62 days.
And it was a historic session. You know, Speaker Egoff on Wednesday night, as we were closing up shop and, you know, getting our stuff in our cars, he went through a laundry list of the things that this legislature accomplished this year. And my goodness, I mean, you know, we tend to take for granted, you know, Chairwoman Armstrong and I probably being inside, we take for granted how much was accomplished. And Chairwoman Armstrong herself, I think, carried some of the biggest pieces of legislation that we passed this year. You know, I carried another chunk of those, but, you know, between the health insurance premium tax that Chairwoman Armstrong led, the historic $110 million tax break for working families and low income families, to House Joint Resolution 1, which for 10 years, it's been a battle to invest a percentage of that permanent fund in early childhood, and now cannabis. So I think a great deal of credit goes to our leadership, to the speaker, to the majority floor leader, to the whip, to the caucus chair, to every single one of the members of the State House of Representatives, particularly on the Democratic side. You know, I think there was an article today in the New Mexican, and it really exemplifies, I think, how much the State House has come to its own, and how much leadership, I think, is emerging from that chamber. And then, of course, the difference that elections make. You know, a lot of these things are not possible on the Senate side without those wonderful six or seven senators that really took the legislature by storm. You know, somebody else that I think deserves a great deal of credit as this bill kind of moved along is Senator Katie Duhigg. I mean, my goodness, whether it was expungement or whether it was the technical aspects of the regulatory framework in cannabis, she was on top of the game every single time, even though she came to the process relatively late. So, you know, I think it was a historic session. I think this bill is historic for many, many reasons, including the fact that we legalized the right way. We've got to keep reminding folks of that. This is not just a legalization framework. This is a legalization framework that ensures that we right the wrongs of the past with communities of color. So I'm proud of the work that our caucus has done, particularly.
I should have said this earlier, but if anybody has questions or comments on this Facebook Live, pop, just drop them in the comments. Sorry, Representative, go ahead.
Oh, that's right. I was going to say the really significant things we did related to healthcare, not only the End of Life Options Act, which was really important to me personally, but we eliminated cost sharing on behavioral health. So for public employees and individual group insurance, we can't touch the self-insured plans. No cost sharing of any kind for any behavioral health service. Not your deductible, not a visit fee, nothing. That's huge and maybe a huge game changer in our behavioral health system. And the affordability fund that Chairman Martinez mentioned, you know, we talk about cannabis raising 30, 50 million conservative, it may be more than that. This fund will raise 160 million new dollars every year into the state, the vast majority of which will be turned around to help people afford buying their insurance. That's huge. And Senator Duhigg, I had a bill that I co-sponsored that we can't send patients to collections anymore for medical debt. That which has been discouraging people from going and getting the care that they need. These are really foundational changes that I think we'll see significant. It's not just tweaking around the system. These are pretty big effects, I think, that we'll see in the coming years.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that opponents of legalization are going to be hesitant to say this was a good thing years down the road. But what are some, are there benchmarks, and what are those benchmarks or signs that we can look for to see if these are, if this is a success or a net positive for the state, you know, 5, 6, 7 years down the road?
You know, I think I don't buy that argument. And here's why. We know that I read a piece this morning. I think 1 in 3 Americans that live in a state with legalized cannabis. That means the federal government will legalize sooner rather than later. And New Mexico will have to follow suit. Now we have two choices. Either we wait until they legalize and then we build whatever framework we're going to build after they do that, or we can lead and create a framework that works for us and then adjust it whenever the federal government legalizes. There is no industry that operates in New Mexico right now that does not have associated costs with it, right? But we do take it as part of doing business, right? And as legislators, it is our job to ensure that we enact policies to limit the negative impacts of those industries on our community. Oil and gas, there is a cost associated with fracking. There is a public health cost. There's a social cost, right? There's a natural resources and environmental cost, right? We don't end fracking. We haven't done that. But what do? We ensure that we have enough protections. Now, whether or not we're doing enough is a question of political debate, right? But we don't, you know, we're not getting rid of the oil and gas industry because of the associated costs with it. So why would we treat cannabis any differently, right? Same thing with alcohol, same thing with tobacco, right? There are associated costs with it. Now, I would argue that the associated costs of legalizing cannabis are much less harmful than the associated costs with any of those other industries I mentioned, right? Will we see an increase in youth use of cannabis? I have reservations that we will, but maybe we will. And so we're going to have to create policies to ensure that that doesn't happen, right? Will we see an increase in DWI? I personally don't think we will, at least not associated with this particular piece of legislation, right? There are other factors that could lead to more DWI. But if we do, then it is our job to mitigate those costs. So, you know, the idea, the notion that, you know, there are too many unknowns here just doesn't hold water for me. And at the end of the day, we're going to have to legalize, right? New Mexico is not going to be the one state that didn't legalize once the feds legalized. So we either do it now, or we do it in 5 years, or we do it in 10 years when the federal government legalizes. I'd rather do it now.
One of the issues I was sort of tracking along in the regular session was this issue of medical cannabis reciprocity. And there was a Senate bill during the regular session that tried to address this issue of the sort of loophole. I won't go into the whole history of it. I think I've written plenty about it, but basically, you know, there was some litigation that was happening and some concerns of, you know, folks coming in and abusing our medical system, mostly from Texas, I guess, and sort of using this loophole. That language is now in the law that's awaiting signature from the governor. Is that all sort of like, you know, a moot point? The people that were concerned about that bill, I mean, because it seems right now, as it stands, if you want to come in from Texas, I mean, once it goes into law, if you want to come from Texas, you can. You don't have to worry about joining the medical program, right? So is that sort of the folks that are concerned about that, is that sort of not a concern anymore?
You know, it won't be as much of a concern because you can get adult use, but if you really, there will be some benefits to the medical, I think, in lower taxes and just being able to access maybe specific grades and of product that is being set aside and reserved for medical. And so we have stuff in this law that would assure that we maintain adequate supply for medical and for caregivers and for their those reciprocal patients. So it's not as important maybe as it was, but I think it may still be important to some.
It seems like there might be some patients or would be patients that don't qualify for one of the 28 conditions, and their workaround was to, you know, like go to California or not even go to California, meet with a doctor online in California and sort of this other loophole. So there was an issue with Texans coming over, but also New Mexicans. Is there any concern about folks that want to get on that program? Is that just something DOH needs to, you know, work towards to maybe broaden those conditions?
You know, I think there's ongoing discussion. You know, the medical advisory committee remains and will continue to discuss if there's other conditions that ought to be added to the medical. And I think part of the issue on California is that California, if you have, you know, that doctor's note or whatever, there's not a kind of a government issued ID. I think that was part of the problem. I hope I'm not misspeaking. So that by saying you had to have a government issued proof of qualifying for a medical program, kind of left California out, if you will, from that loophole. But, you know, I think that they will continue to monitor medical and the conditions and make sure there's adequate access. And I do think you'll see continued boutique kind of treatment of medical cannabis so that you've got certain strains and different levels of THC and so forth for different symptoms. I mean, you go into a dispensary now and there's a whole different variety. Depends, let's talk about your symptoms. Are you having trouble sleeping or are you throwing up? You know, or is it pain? And what's the best plant strain and level of THC for those symptoms? And I certainly hope that we're protecting the ability to do that and protecting supply for those who need that medical.
We heard some concern in the session and ahead of the special session from folks in traditional rural communities. We had Moises Gonzalez on the podcast recently from the land grant community. And this also came out in the debate regarding whether they will be cut out of entering this new industry because of these larger established players already here in the medical cannabis industry. How does the legislation address that?
Well, first and foremost, you know, I'm very proud that through the development of this legislation over the past 5 years, many meetings and conversations have been had with communities across the state, including folks from Acequias and others. You know, the notion that folks in rural communities and historic ancestral land grants or Acequias will be left out is simply not true. You know, these points were raised with me as the main sponsor of this bill toward the end of the 60-day session. Now, Paula Garcia from the Acequia Association, I have a great relationship with her. We've worked together on many other things in the past. She reached out and she said, we've got some concerns. And it wasn't so much with the bill. It was the fact that we had left some of those funds out, right? Because of the compromise we had reached with this bill early on, but because they had been so tied up with other work that they were doing, they weren't able to raise it as soon as they could have. And so we worked with Ms. Garcia over the course of the last 10 days of the session on a number of amendments that ended up actually in House Bill 2. So they were no longer amendments; they were part of the bill. But I should also add that Ms. Garcia has been amazing to work with, and we're going to continue to collaborate to ensure that the community she represents and other communities are well taken care of, right? Because they raised some good points. The notion, though, that they're going to get cut out is simply not true, and I would invite folks to think that to read the bill. The fact that we have a micro business licensing framework that ensures easy access into the marketplace is a game changer. You know, the licensing fees, for example, are I believe it's $1,000 for a micro cannabis producers and a $2,500 license for up to, so it could actually be a little bit less, for a fully integrated micro business license. So you could do everything from seed to retail sale. You know, I was a little disappointed in one of the reports that I read where a claim was made that a micro business licensee couldn't sell. That's not true. It's never been true. There's always been the ability to sell within that license. And so, you know, I coming from an organizing perspective, coming from a social justice perspective, where this has been my life's work, I will always fight to ensure that the communities, you know, the least amongst us have the ability to benefit, not just from this industry, from everything, right? As Chairwoman Armstrong said, healthcare, right? Not sending people to collections because they couldn't pay their cancer treatment bill, right? Not cutting people out of healthcare because they don't have immigration status. I mean, that's our life's work. Why would we, through a cannabis legalization bill, all of a sudden just leave out entire communities? That is not the case. Now, in practice, could it potentially turn otherwise? Of course, right? Of course. And we, going back to the beginning of this conversation, we are committed to ensuring that this piece of legislation, hopefully soon enough, this new statute in our code continues to evolve to meet the needs of the communities that are going to be impacted by this, for good or for ill, right? So you know, we will continue to work with them to make sure that we protect and we allow that access into the industry so that every community can thrive. But again, in practice, it could be different. And if that's the case, we're going to be back here, you know, in 9 months to fix whatever needs to be fixed. But, you know, I really, and one last thing on that point. I had more calls than I can remember with folks from a lot of these different groups between the time the session ended and between the time the special session began. And not only that, but we had a full out two and a half hour meeting with a number of these folks on the Saturday before the special session began to explain what was in the bill, because there was a lot of misinformation in those circles running around that unfortunately made its way to the media, made its way into public forums. And you know, people are scared, right? If you are misinformed, right, and you are not presented with the facts and the truth, your gut reaction is to push back, right? But I believe we were able to inform and get accurate information out there. And people were, you know, at the end of the day, I think, satisfied with what we proposed.
Let me ask a related question. I think there are ongoing questions brought up in the special session debate about water usage. How much will be required? Will this take away from other water usage, like municipalities or for other crops? How will this be addressed, do you think, going forward?
Part of the licensing requirement will be that you prove that you've got access to water, to a water right, to something, whether it's commercial or otherwise. You will not be licensed if you cannot show otherwise. Now, you know, the question of cannabis and water, you know, this is after all an agricultural product, right? And landowners with access to water will make an economic decision as to whether they want to grow cannabis or they want to grow green chili, right? That is an economic decision for them to make. You know, nothing in the bill would allow a large company to come in and steal water from the Acequias to water their massive cannabis farm, right? Nothing in the bill would allow for that to happen. And in fact, in the bill, we have some pretty strong language to ensure that the regulators come up with the rules that they will implement to ensure that that doesn't happen. You know, whether or not cannabis is water intensive, I mean, I think, you know, is it more water intensive than alfalfa, right? Is it more water intensive than pecans, right? Is it more water intensive than any other crop? You know, it's probably more intensive than some and not as intensive as others. Those are all economic decisions that people will be making, but the regulators will make sure that nobody comes in and gets a license to grow cannabis who doesn't have access to water and can't prove that they have access to water.
Well, thank you, representatives. That's all my questions, unless Andy has any follow-up.
Thank you both.
Well, thank you for this series and for letting us round it out at the end.
Thank you both very much. And thank you to our listeners. This was another episode of Growing Forward. It's the collaboration between New Mexico Political Report and New Mexico PBS. You can find additional episodes wherever you get your podcasts. And please, if you have just a second, leave us a review to let us know how we're doing. Our producers are Kevin McDonald and Bryce Dix. Our theme music is from Christian Bjorklund. And a special thank you to Catherine Conley for designing our logo. Also, tune in on Thursday morning to KUNM to hear Megan hosting Let's Talk New Mexico. She'll be doing another wrap-up of the special session.